The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. The ACOI Luncheon Lecture, Medicine for the Boards, is presented by Dr. Scott Spradlin.
One thing, here's the slide that come up missing, the last point. And the reason I wanted to show it to you real quick before we get started on the office medicine piece. You see here, we talked about diffusion-weighted and perfusion-weighted imaging, how helpful it is when we're going through that type of imaging. As you can see on the left from the diffusion weight, that you can actually see the lesion, that area that's kind of highlighted in white. When you do a perfusion scan, you can actually see from the colors the entire area that's being affected by that. And so that's the penumbra. And really gives you, really ties immediately from that imaging into the actual physical exam that you're doing and what you're finding. So sorry for that not being in the deck there, but that was just trying to tie that in now. So without any further ado here, we will go to the presentation. So as Kevin said, you know, this one seems to be missing over here. Can we have that corrected? This video seems to be a little bit off on this one. As Kevin said, when I took my first research, I come back and I said there's stuff that was on there that we don't really hit on. And so this is kind of the kitchen sink drawer of where we kind of put some of this. And as you can see, some of it is getting culminated. But really, it's some common tasks, some medical ethics, some preventive guidelines, review of the vaccinations, and then kind of talking about some board questions and then some pictures. More so just trying to run through as you're eating there to help kind of fine tune and top off what we've been talking about today. So essentially when you look at a high level, why do we do CAT scans? Well, we do CAT scans to look for cranial bleeds. We do them to look for kidney stones. We do them to look for appendicitis, and we can do them to evaluate diverticulitis. It's important for you to say that the differentiation between the CTs and MRs, because with the MRs, as we've seen already this morning, evaluation of CNS disease like multiple sclerosis, avascular necrosis is not going to show up on a CAT scan. It's going to be something we'll see on an MR, aseptic necrosis, and of course, the spinal cord diseases for that highlight. So some common tests, just to refresh your memory as you sit there and eat. VQ scans, go be positive if we have a segmental mismatch perfusion defect. And if we've got if we're looking at for a pre-pneumonectomy clearance, it really needs to be, FEV1 needs to really be greater than 800 cc's. A bone scan, a negative scan rules out osteomyelitis. It's very sensitive for Paget's disease. It's one of the best screens for bone metastasis, but it will be negative in multiple myeloma. And don't know if that's still on board exams, but it certainly was a focus on the one when I first took it many, many years ago. IVP, purpose now is to evaluate for obstructive concerns. And remember, really to use the CT to evaluate for anatomic concerns. Thyroid scan, as you saw, Dr. Sutton and Dr. Snitzer always speak to this, but when you're doing a thyroid scan, it's increased in Graves and decreased in thyroiditis. And it never fails on a board exam. Somewhere, there's always a question about pheochromocytoma, and then you always have the MIBG scan, and it's important for you just to refresh yourself that it's positive in about 1 or 2 days. For that. You heard a discussion about low alkaline phosphatase this morning, but don't get caught up in seeing those lab tests when they come along. So some of the key things here with alkaline phosphatase is think about BLIP. And really, it's bone, liver, intestine, and placenta is the way I kind of use it as a mnemonic. And so, you know, it's going to be elevated in late pregnancy, in bone metastasis, Paget's disease, and osteomalacia. Liver, primary sclerosing cholangitis, primary biliary cirrhosis, and cholecystitis and liver disease, you're going to have elevated alk phos. It never fails that as internists and into the evolution is preoperative management. And not only does it occur in our everyday, but it's something that the boards like to touch on. So the perioperative mortality rate for all surgeries is about 0.3%. Most perioperative deaths, about 55% of them occur in the first 48 hours postoperatively. And of those deaths, 35% are occurring in the operating room, and about 10% are occurring during anesthesia. Pulmonary complications are the most common perioperative complication. Cardiac complications are the most common cause of perioperative death. Perioperative MIs usually occur by postoperative day 3, and almost 50% of those are fatal. And thus the rationale for evaluating people's activity. Make sure you feel comfortable with METs. Where really one MET is kind of essentially low level, you know, walking indoors, eating, kind of like what you're doing now. Greater than 4 is really climbing those flight of stairs, even though I think those stairs might be excessive. I don't know how you feel. And then, of course, greater than 10 is really putting into play people that are active in sports and less sedentary. So to evaluate what the activity is of the person you're actually evaluating. And then we're going to divide the surgical risk into really 3 categories: low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk. Those low risk procedures, much like you heard the other day, you know, don't prophylact for mitral valve and et cetera, is that these endoscopic procedures, really superficial procedures, cataract surgery, breast surgery, really low risk and don't require an extensive amount of workup unless you have known issues. Intermediate risk surgeries are those, they're endarterectomies, abdominal aortic aneurysm repair, head and neck surgery, orthopedic surgeries, prostate surgery. And then the high risk are, of course, what we would expect, those peripheral vascular procedures and aortic surgeries, and those probably have concomitant other comorbidities, thus the reason they're having them. So it comes down to a board question: what do you need to know, Scott, and how can you bubble this down so I can have a takeaway? Well, I think it's fair for you to be able to have an idea of when you should postpone or cancel surgery. Some of this is common sense, but we'll run through them pretty quick. Anyone who has unstable angina or unstable coronary disease, before surgery, you need to have that canceled until evaluation was done. Arrhythmias, any type of Mobitz type 2, AV block, any type of ventricular arrhythmias. Symptomatic bradycardia is going to be something that you would cancel and work up. Severe aortic stenosis, and that's really going to be classified as anything greater than 40 millimeters of mercury. Or the aortic valve area is very tight, less than 1 centimeter. Symptomatic mitral stenosis would be another one. Clinical risk factors that should be in the risk assessment, but not reasons for stopping, are certainly the history of heart disease, history of compensated or prior heart failure, and if these are stable, don't grab the hook to go and do excessive testing. History of stroke, ongoing diabetes, those particularly being relatively well controlled, and then renal insufficiency. So pre-surgery labs, as we all know, this varies, but it's intense because people go and get pre-op labs done now by individuals at outpatient facilities, and it's quite robust. So for a board exam, if they were to ask you what are the necessary pre-surgery labs, hematocrit is necessary for anyone over the age of 65, and any surgery that's going to involve blood loss. Electrolytes is not necessarily a known reason to monitor. If there's actually someone that has an abnormality with electrolytes, that would be fine. But if there's no known issues, there's no reason to order electrolytes. EKGs or ECGs for any vascular procedures, major surgery, those people that have concomitant comorbidities such as coronary disease, diabetes, or hypertension. Chest x-rays only needed if they've got respiratory or cardiac disease or they're over the age of 50. And pulmonary function tests only if you have an unexplained respiratory issue. So if someone has stable, controlled COPD, there would not be a reason to do a PFT. So let's summarize some perioperative risk. You know, there's three things we're really combining here when we're looking at surgical risk. One is the clinical, which is the easiest for us. The functional status, we talked about activity. And then the specific surgery risk, and we talked about how we kind of broke those into three categories. So patients with active cardiac condition should not undergo elective surgery until it's actually, that condition's been treated and stabilized. If you have no clinical risk factors, you can proceed to surgery without non-invasive cardiac testing, meaning you do not have to have an echo, you do not have to have a stress test, et cetera. And those individuals with good functional status can proceed without any type of cardiac stress testing or ultrasounds. Low-risk surgical procedures can proceed to surgery without non-invasive cardiac testing as well, as you would only imagine. So if we have patients with one or two clinical risk factors who are undergoing an intermediate risk surgery, which we just looked at, or vascular surgery, or with a poor or unknown functional status, should be treated with perioperative beta blockade or consider non-invasive cardiac testing before moving to surgery. And people that have three or more of these should be managed very similarly unless they're undergoing vascular surgery, any vascular surgery, in which case they should undergo non-invasive cardiac testing before any type of intervention is done. Let's touch a little bit on medical ethics. There's going to be some terms that could pop up that I want to make sure you're good on, because it never fails that it's a fair game to have a medical ethics question, and I call this kind of the Webster's glossary test. Beneficence is the duty to act in the best interest of the patient. Non-malfeasance is the duty to do no harm. And respect to the patient's autonomy is duty to the patient to make free choices of their own. And justice, duty to treat all patients fairly. These are the four attributes that are very, very important that a physician must exercise as part of their ethical, as at least a minimum of their ethical contributions to taking care in that partnership with a patient. As far as legality goes, regarding CPR and do not resuscitate, a physician has to determine whether or not CPR would be futile based on the clinical sequela. They have to take into account the preferences of that patient, because there's a lot of ifs, ands, or buts about how they sometimes stratify those in some of their living wills. And that you must try to quantify the expected quality of life. Brain death. Physicians may stop treatment if a person is clinically brain dead. It would be helpful if we have ethics committee review. We don't necessarily always have that in all our facilities. So therefore, that's sometimes present. Where it is, it's good. An EEG is not required for this diagnosis, but I would say it's helpful. And organs can be donated without the patient's prior consent. So let's go through an example of what could potentially be a board question. A 55-year-old man is diagnosed with cancer. As his treating physician, you talk about the treatment medically, but also discuss the social needs and support he'll need. He asks you to not tell his wife. What's your obligation? Well, your obligation is that your relationship with your patient is one that you honor. And when it's, I think that the back and forth of talking about the importance of this treatment, understanding that if they've got a cancer and they're going to have to go through a considerable amount of therapy, that how could you even hide that? And that But honestly, from that standpoint, you have to honor what the patient is asking you to do. That's the ethical thing. However, if it was a different diagnosis, and it was HIV, or it was a if it was any disease that could be potentially harmful to a spouse or to any family member, we have to inform the patient that we have a legal route to discuss that with the family and ask them to do it first. But I think that's an important thing, and I think that's a fair question. I want you to be kicked off. The thing is that if you have a chance, there, and you may have already done this, but there is a site on the AOA where you can go and talk about the code of ethics and be able to read the rules that exist. Many states that you practice in have their own rules and guidances, as well as hospitals. So I think that's an important thing for us to think about. My most recent test, I had an ethics question. So let's go in and talk about some preventive medicine. You've seen some of this pop up. You've seen throughout the course of this week, and you also even saw some of it this morning. But I think it's important for us to look at the U.S. Preventive Task Force, because these are reasonable questions for to be pimped on about when to do certain screenings. Regarding breast cancer, mammography is essentially recommended every 1 to 2 years for age women 50 to 74. However, if a person is over the age of 74 and you get that question on a test, then based on the United States Preventive Task Force guidelines, you would not do that based upon no other symptomatology. So it's important for you to take the clinical criteria that you have along with someone that's asymptomatic. There's also insufficient evidence to recommend for or against a breast exam alone or screen for breast cancer, and that there is insufficient evidence to recommend against teaching or performing routine self-breast exams based on the U.S. Preventive Task Force. However, given the fact that if you have symptoms or if you have known disease, that could be completely different, but this would be a routine person that had no history whatsoever. Screening for cervical cancer, a recommendation that women aged 21 to 65 have cytology every 3 years, or women ages 30 to 65 who want to lengthen the screen with a combination of cytology and HPV testing every 5 years. There is recommendations that against screening in women who for cervical cancer in less than age 21. And there's recommendations against cervical cancer screening in women age 65 or older who have had normal testing and are not considered to be at high risk. The task force also recommends against routine pap smear screening in women who have had a total hysterectomy for benign disease. Colorectal cancer. There's a strong recommendation that men and women 50 to 75 years of age or older be screened for colorectal cancer. Those individuals who are older than 75, meaning 76 and higher, must have a risk factor to have this colorectal screening done. Now, the way that it's been classified right now by the task force is that's fecal occult blood testing, barium enema, sigmoid, or colonoscopy. There is no recommendation right now on virtual colonography or fecal DNA. Screening for ovarian cancer. There is no recommendation at this time for screening for ovarian cancer with CA-125 or ultrasound or pelvic exam. Screening for abdominal aneurysms has been out for a few years in men aged 65 to 75 who have ever smoked, that there is a recommendation to do a one-time abdominal aortic aneurysm screening. There is no recommendation in men 65 to 75 who have never smoked. And there is no recommendation against screening for abdominal aortic aneurysm in women. Coronary disease. For those that have no symptoms, the task force recommends against ECGs, exercise treadmill tests, electron beam CT, for either the presence of severe CAS or the prediction of coronary disease in adults at low risk for coronary heart disease. So you'd have to have symptoms for that recommendation to come through. One that I continue to tell you year and year is that every time someone comes into your office, what do you get? You get a temperature, you get a blood pressure, you get a respiration. For the purpose of a board test, saying every time they come in is not a guideline. And so therefore, adults age 18 or older should be screened for high blood pressure, and they should be having that checked at least every 2 years. Screening for lipids. Very important that anyone age 35, men over 35 and women age 45 and older should be screened for lipid disorders and abnormal lipids. There's also a component of screening younger adults age 20 to 35 and women age 20 to 45 if they have severe risk for coronary disease. Chlamydia. Women aged 24 years and younger and other symptomatic women at increased risk for infection for chlamydia. The U.S. Preventive Task Force recommends that clinicians routinely screen all asymptomatic women aged 24 years and younger and others at increased risk for chlamydia infection. Hormonal treatment. There is no recommendation to present time for estrogen and progestin for the prevention of chronic conditions in postmenopausal women. And as you saw this morning, it actually runs to an increased risk of not only stroke, but potentially cardiovascular disease. And they recommend against the completely against the routine use of unopposed estrogen. Type 2 diabetes. The evidence is insufficient to recommend for or against routine screening of asymptomatic adults for type 2, but they do recommend screening for type 2 diabetes in adults with hypertension or hyperlipidemia. Osteoporosis, screening is recommended for any women age 65 and older be routinely screened for osteoporosis. And right now there's no recommendation for or against screening postmenopausal women who are younger than 60 or in women age 60 to 64 who are not at a known increase of risk of osteoporotic fractures. Lung cancer has been a task force recommendation that came out the past few years. For low-dose CT in adults age 55 to 80 who have a 30-pack year history of smoking and currently smoke or have quit within 15 years. I think that's been out long enough now that that would be something people would want to be checking for the boards. Regarding genetic testing, you heard some genetic testing today, but the task force really does recommend screening for women who have had family members with breast, ovarian, tubal, or peritoneal cancers for BRCA1 and BRCA2 susceptibility. And if they are positive, they should receive counseling and testing. That's a very important part, because a lot of times we do the test, we explain to people what the test is, but do you have documented counseling after the testing with a genetic person? Carotid artery stenosis. I recommend against screening for asymptomatic carotid stenosis in the general population. And hepatitis C, as we all know, those individuals that are born between 1945 and 1965 do need a one-time screening. And there has been a very good response to that and a lot of concern around individuals with that, and you see that doing well. One of the things that doesn't pop up so much on the recertification of the boards as it does the initial would be internists being able to determine between live and dead viruses. This slide kind of helps with that. Zoster, or shingle shot, as people talked about a lot here the past couple of days, that's a live attenuated virus. I think that's fair. Also MMR, oral polio, nasal flu, and yellow fever is a live virus. BCG is a live bacteria. Polio, rabies, and flu are dead viruses. And cholera, H. influenza, pneumococcal, and the meningococcal are dead bacteria. So let's look through some retinal images. You've seen a couple of them associated with disease. I want you to get used to being able to look at these on a test to quickly get the responses needed. So one of the things that you want to look at when you look at the fundus, you want to look at the disc, you want to look at the vasculature, and you want to look at all the other stuff that's laying out there. So it's important that if you don't see the disc completely well, or you see decreased vascularity or asymmetry, that it could potentially be. So what do you think this one would be? We've got a relatively decent disc, got some vascularity, and you've got some yellow stuff out there. That is macular degeneration. It's pretty classic macular degeneration, and they didn't give me a pointer, but you can see that right out in the little areas that are lit up on the outside of the macular degeneration. Whenever you see a bright light on these things, it's usually an itis, but here you want to quickly look at the disc, you look at the vascularity, and you can look at the microhemorrhaging that's occurring there kind of in the center. This is a CMV retinitis. Anytime you see that flash of light, think itis. That would be a CMV retinitis. Here's an image of one that shows another kind of explosion or sunspot. You see the disc is intact. The vascularity looks relatively intact. That's a toxoplasmosis. Here's one. Definitely should be on the boards. You've got a disc. You've got some vascularity. As you can see, some of that vascularity more toward the right of that fundus is kind of narrowed. You can actually see the exudate and the hemorrhage out there. Anybody have an idea what that is? Diabetic retinopathy. It's pretty classic diabetic retinopathy. Here's one of a fundus that's got what you would appear when you first look at it, as you look across that eye, is you see almost, looks like golden nuggets right across there are crystals, and that's exactly what that is. See those little yellow crystals? That is cholesterolosis. Here's one that clearly shows a very, very bad hemorrhage within the eye. You can kind of see an active hemorrhage as well as intermittent. That's what that dark is that is dried blood back in there. It's not been evacuated. This would be a sickle cell retinopathy. The reason I have this slide on here, or this picture on here, is you can remember, even though when we talk about malignancies, one of the things that we think about immediately is, well, do they have a CT or an MRI? Well, you got to remember, an eye is the closest thing we have with an ophthalmoscope to look into the brain. And this one gives a pretty classic example of you got a normal disc, vascularity seems pretty much okay, but you have kind of a dark area right in the center with that. And this is actually a metastatic disease lesion on a fundoscopic exam. Here's an image to kind of focus on the disc of a disc that's not really clear, right? We don't see that nice little round thing. We see a lot of hemorrhage. We see it in one half of the eye, right? The south pole of the eye, everything seems pretty good. It's infiltrating over, but we've got a lot of hemorrhage. And what would anyone consider that to be? That's a retinal vein occlusion. Okay. Now, one of the things that comes up is a lot about strabismus and eye movement and muscle laxity. This is one of the things I'll throw out to you to remember quick for the boards, is LR6SO43. The lateral rectus is controlled by nerve 6. The superior oblique is by 4, and all the rest of them are covered by cranial nerve 3. So it'll help you in case you get one of those questions and go, dang, I shouldn't miss that. So I want to talk a little bit about dementia to throw in here, because we talked about a lot of neurological issues over the course of the morning. One of the things, the reason I think dementia is something that's important, is it comes up in the office a lot, talking about your older patients. The literature's out there now with a lot of panic that people are overdiagnosed Alzheimer's to the nth degree. There's concerns that many people have some form of dementia, but they're not necessarily Alzheimer's. So, dementia is a progressive deterioration, as we know. There's no real altered consciousness, as in a delirium, but 80% of people with dementia have been presumed to be having Alzheimer's. And that number is not as bad in the past year or two as it was before, because we're beginning to see some of this evolution. But there are some, the differentiation between Parkinson's and dementia is pretty clear. The key is to being able to determine whether a person has early signs of dementia or they have depression. And really, you've got to make sure that as a delineator between the depression and the dementia is really a memory loss concern from family and friends, the mini mental status exam is showing less than 24, and then their affect is normal. If their affect's not normal, you could be adding a concomitant. But the treatment for that certainly is simpler than sticking the fork into that dementia, because you don't make that over one visit, but multiple visits and multiple stories. And you treat that with the cholinesterase inhibitors. But there are other diseases, and I hear them more from friends that tell me the most horrible stories. My mother has Alzheimer's, and I go, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that." And then about 6 months later, I hear the story about she's in a nursing home, and she's really bad. And I go, "Really?" And all at once, I started saying, "What's happening out there?" And the key is that I'm hearing quite a few stories, and we actually begin to see it populate more in the neurological literature about Lewy bodies disease, where we have a progressive cognitive decline. They have hallucinations. They have Parkinsonian features. They have sleep disturbances. And some of these have so much overlap that it's hard to differentiate and discern that without good histories. Pick's disease is another one, with frontotemporal dementia. It's a very progressive disease. It looks very much like dementia on one visit, and then the next thing you have is a rapid decline. Language deficits. These people aren't talking in 6 months after they get diagnosed with questionable Alzheimer's. And you see people saying, "Well, we've maxed the therapy with no treatment or no improvement." And they have apathy, disinhibition, emotional disturbances, and the CT MRIs will show the frontal and temporal atrophy. And there's really no definitive treatment, but it's really one that I think is easier to pick up, and the awareness of some of these other components, that it's not a knee-jerk to an Alzheimer's dementia, but there are other components very early on in the close monitoring. So let's look at some quick questions of what would be on a board. As I joked about this morning, we used to have a book of questions and we had a book of pictures and lab tests. And I really honestly learned how to use all five of those fingers very well to be able to flip back and forth for that question. Today, the test is so much sweeter because you have all those pictures you can click on and you can pull them up. But they're the questions are appropriately very short. And so don't overread into a question, which is one of the easiest things to do with a short question, is almost as bad as it is with a long question. So a 19-year-old presents with a 2-day history of cough, runny nose, headache, and congestion. He's been having a low-grade fever. His temperature's 99. Nasal mucosa is red, yellowish secretions, and the lungs are coarse but clear with cough. Next best course of action would be mucolytics and Tylenol, chest radiograph, mucolytics and Tylenol, macrolide antibiotic, mucolytics and acetaminophen. No action needed. It's a virus, amoxicillin, mucolytics and acetaminophen. And you've had Dr. Blackburn talking about this. Not only did he talk about it with you guys, I was over in the hospital course yesterday and he spent a lot of time on that over there too. So the best course of action would be mucolytics and Tylenol, right? Because as they've clearly seen, if you remember that nice big graph that he showed you, couldn't have been set up any well when he was talking about pneumonia, was the fact that you really, the rhinoviruses and the flu are the real drivers. However, if you believe you're getting that bacterial overflow, then you need to cover for that staph and strep. But until then, remember the knee-jerk reaction. Every person that goes into an urgent care almost with a cold will come out with an antibiotic. And that's what they're going after, right? So a 60-year-old comes in for an annual exam, past medical history, significant for hypertension. She had a total hysterectomy with her ovaries removed for benign disease in her 20s. She's on hypertensive medications, otherwise no allergies. Regarding the pap smear, what's the next best course of treatment? She's over 60 and has no need for a pap smear. She's post-hysterectomy and doesn't need a pap smear. She needs a pap smear with HPV. She needs a pap smear because we do not know the last three pap smears. She does not need a pap smear because she's over 60, and I don't have the surgery report to confirm. Yeah, she's over 60 and has no need for a pap smear. 32-year-old with a history of intermittent back pain, presents with left leg pain. Pain starts in the lower back and the buttocks area, radiates down the left leg, states the pain seems to be worse at night. Patient's very healthy. He is an amateur bicycle racer and rides daily. For those of us that know that, we know that he probably has some chronic irritation in that area that could cause these symptoms. His neuro exam is essentially normal. His spine's non-tender. He has tenderness in the left buttocks area. It's difficult for the patient to tiptoe on his left foot. The rest of his neurological exam, including deep tendon reflexes, are normal. Which of the following is the most probable cause of this patient's pain? L5, S1, sciatica, peroneal nerve. It's going to be sciatica. He's irritated his piriformis, he's irritated his sciatica. If he had a diminished reflex, it could be pushing toward the L5, but right now it's probably more just acute sciatica. 34-year-old mildly obese woman presents with complaints of having had an episode of blindness in her left eye. Symptoms last approximately 5 hours and then resolve. She has otherwise been in good health and does aerobic exercises 3 times a week. She notices she has exercised since the episode, seems to have some dimming of the vision in her left eye. She's a non-smoker and a non-drinker. She has 5 children. On physical exam, the pupil does not constrict when light is shown directly into her eye through consensual constriction is intact. She's otherwise normal exam. What is the following diagnosis is most consistent with this patient's signs and symptoms? If I told you the pupil accommodated but didn't react, that would be an Argyle Robinson's pupil, right? Well, what's this one? This is optic neuritis. 42-year-old homeless man, chronic alcoholic, comes in with impaired balance and decreased mental status, poor cognition. What's the most probable cause of this patient's problem? This would be going after the Wernicke-Korsakoff, so it's the Wernicke encephalopathy. If he had had confabulation, it would have been Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. You're consulted for a previously healthy 34-year-old woman who presents with complaints of weakness in her upper arms. It's been going on for 2 months, slowly getting worse. She's a waitress. She knows it's been especially difficult to put glasses in the cabinets on physical exam. Got some tenderness in her upper arm and thigh muscles. She has mildly decreased biceps, triceps, and deltoid strength. It's difficult to tell whether the strength extinguishes when repeated testing because the patient's non-compliant. You do some blab work because you're not sure. CK comes back 300, SED rate comes back 60. Everything else kind of normal. What's the next thing you do? Do you put her on prednisone, get a muscle biopsy, do some more tests with an ANA and RA, or do we do a draphonium test? We need to get a muscle biopsy. This is clearly one, it's got CK, it needs a muscle biopsy. This is one where it's probably reasonable to do the muscle biopsy, unlike the temporal arteritis discussion we had earlier today. 65-year-old is brought in the family for you for evaluation for abnormal gait, increased falling, decreased mental status. Her family states she's extreme difficulty navigating the stairs. She's been more forgetful. On exam, you see her with flat affect, masked facies. She's got tenseness in her neck and trunk. Her neck is mildly hyperextended. She has trouble looking up and down. Her gait is slowed. And these people will tell you, I no longer can do anything in my kitchen. Or I no longer like to get in the car and go out because I've been scared I'm running lights. They don't want to put their head up or down. Which of the following would you most likely think of this patient? And if you paid attention this morning, you'd say it's. And what's the most appropriate treatment? This is progressive supranuclear palsy, and there is no treatment. All right, so here's my stroke question driving home. I've got a 62-year-old person with a history of hypertension and questionable heart fluttering, was brought into the ER with a mental status change. You were called down to evaluate. Blood pressure is 189 over 80. Heart's irregular, rate 103. Neurologically, she's flaccid on the left upper extremity and lower extremity. She's got upgoing toes. She has a conjugate gaze to the right and aphasic. You got a scan in front of you. You can see when you look at it, you got an area there that's showing some swelling. You see the ventricle being diminished, and you look at that bilateral view. Now you don't get a good view there, but here you got a good view, so look over here. And what's your diagnosis? Really, this is probably a right ischemic stroke, because we really didn't have a history of TIAs. It's probably a middle cerebral area we talked about earlier, and which area is the middle cerebral artery. So a 59-year-old comes in with a no medical history, presents with weakness and fatigue. There's no other history that has slowly gotten worse over the past few months. You note that he's got fasciculations on exam, and he actually complains about his muscles jumping back and forth, says, "Drive me nuts, doc." And arms and legs and lower extremity weakness is worse proximally than distally. He's hyperreflexic on deep tendon reflexes, and his CK is 400. From this morning's talk, you would most likely go after the answer of this man has Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's the most common anterior horn disease, and it's, of course, Lou Gehrig's. So I'm speeding along here, and I'm going to take you through some other pictures. Here is a fundoscopic exam finding of the following. You see the disc, you see some white material. What is your diagnosis? Is this a retinal vein occlusion? Is it a cholesterol embolism? Is it temporal arteritis, toxoplasmosis, or retinoschisis? This is a cholesterol embolism. Get presented this picture of a woman who has a deformity in her leg. You take a look at it, and the answer is this is lipoatrophy. This is rhabdomyolysis, myositis ossificans, or syphilitic guma. This is lipoatrophy. It usually comes from injections of insulin. Here's another one, and I don't think it'll make the boards now, but now we've got medications to treat it, so it's going to come. You've got a man that has general muscle loss here on the picture around the clavicular scapular area. Is this from a brachial plexopathy, clavicle fracture, lipodystrophy, polyostic fibrous dysplasia, or rupture of the trapezius muscle? This is lipodystrophy, and we're getting medications to help treat that are coming out into the mainframe. Classic question that kind of gears you is that you have a patient who presents with unilateral rhinorrhea. What is the diagnosis? Is it a nasal foreign body? Well, when you look at the exam, osteoma, pituitary tumor, skull fracture, or sinusitis. It's a pituitary tumor. Anytime you hear the word, that's the key words, unilateral rhinitis. You have a person that had a sulfur colloid scan, and these items still do exist on tests. Was performed after a patient presented with abdominal pain. How Jolly bodies were present on the peripheral smear, which you know kind of leads you, which you will learn. You won't learn that till tomorrow, but you know it already. Functional asplenia. What do you think the diagnosis would be? Clearly be a pelvic spleen. You can see that spleen down there. And what's probably happened is that pelvic spleen is torqued, and that's what's causing the abdominal pain. Patient with a history of rheumatoid arthritis presented with several months history of painful left calf. Make sure that you don't call this a DVT, even though it's not in here. But the key word here, it's going to steer you to where this is going, is rheumatoid arthritis. And even though there's several month history, but a painful left calf, they're going to say it's swollen. This is a Baker's cyst. Baker's cysts look a lot like DVTs. Yeah. And just about as painful. Here's another fundoscopic exam. Remember I told you about the explosion of the light, that flashback toward you? You see that the disc is completely eroded here, and that you also have that's edema around that disc. You also see, believe it or not, look, see the vasculature up at about 1 or 2 o'clock on that film versus 3, 4, 5, and 6. Actually, if you look at it a little bit longer, you can kind of see at the bottom of the eye, it looks like a big bowl of fluid down there. That is clearly showing a lot of activity in this eye, and this is malignant hypertension, because those little guys right there are cotton wool spots, and then actually you've got a retinal detachment from that malignant hypertension. That's why you see the fluid in the inferior aspect of that eye. So here's one, kind of to the point I was driving home today. You got, what physical findings would be expected in the presence of this patient with this image? So we take a look. We see some swelling over on the right side of the brain. You see a little bit of a hyperdense area there. Remember, it's left hemiparesis and gaze deviated to the right. This is really an internal capsule. Remember, internal capsules go act just like our middle cerebral infarct. Here's one that patient presents to the office, says, "Doc, do I have skin cancer?" The answer is what is this diagnosis? This is actually a traumatic bleb, not a melanoma. Which of the following signs would you expect on this 76-year-old woman with anemia? And when you look at the spinal cord and you think about anemia, you think about what could be happening there. If you look up at that MR, you can see right there between C2 and C5, definitely some changes along those lines, that hyperdense area. You can kind of see it better. It starts at C2 and ends up down about C5. It would be Romberg's sign, because this lady has pernicious anemia. Here's another fundus eye finding of a little bit different than what you have seen so far. You've seen the uveitises. This is clearly not a uveitis. This is a columboma, and it's relatively just an abnormal closure of the optic fissure. You can have some issues where that is related to some optic disc with some severe visual, but this is relatively benign. What clinical presentation would be expected in this patient? Okay, so you're looking at the image. Really, everything looks relatively normal, and you're sitting here going, okay, I don't see the ventricles. I'm down in the brain. So we're down in the lower part of the brain, right? There is an area of hyper density right in the center. This is really more brain stem. And as we talked about this morning, we would expect this to be quadriplegia because of the mixed motor and sensory in brainstem. What's the diagnosis here? Well, we know clearly that the brain squished over. We don't see a stroke in there, but we've got some form of hematoma. Which one is it? This is the epidural, right? Here's something I was referring to earlier when we talked about central pontine myelinolysis, is that this is a patient with chronic alcoholism presented with dysarthria and horizontal nystagmus, as we talked about. When you look at this MR, look at the pons, and you can see that dense lesion in there. So this is really a case of a tumor within the pons, and that's where you get CPM, or number 2, central pontine myelinolysis. Here's an example of one that I threw in, because I'm not addicted to eyes, but I'm trying to show you different ones, and this is a corneal photograph. As you look right at the bottom of there, you can kind of see that dendritic finding right there at right below where the flash of light is. You can kind of see it across there. That is herpes. So that's herpes simplex. Which one of the following visual disturbances would be predicted to demonstrate on the exam of this patient? As you can see, when you look into the fundus, All I want you seeing a white plaque kind of right in the center there. It's a little bit different. And then all I want you to see the vascularity. So you know that there's a visual field lost here. So we've got a plaque blocked in here. And so what you would get from that is inferior hemifield loss. And I have seen that question before. Here's another one of another eye. A number of different things around the fundus. This one clearly is not part of an optic closure issue. As you can see, it's different than the pupil. It's kind of brown turning to black. So this is blood. And this is where an irritation has occurred and is essentially being absorbed. What is this? This is a hyphema. And here's another fundus exam. Driving home the point, do you see an optic disc? No. Does it look like there's swelling there? Yes. Do you see the cotton wool spots? Yes. Do you see the hemorrhage? So this is malignant hypertension. Here's a picture of a person that had the following neurological issues. When you look across here, you can clearly see the asymmetry. On the right side of this, you can clearly see where there is a whited up hyperlucent area. That's a blockage. So what symptoms would you expect out of that? You'd expect hemiplegia, because this is middle cerebral artery occlusion, right? I'll punch through that one. I'll let you look at that one. I won't, because I'm running out of time. Here's one. Patients most likely are presented with which of the following findings? Once again, you look, this is an image of vascularity, a CT angiogram. And so you look over on the right side, seems like pretty good perfusion. On the left side, you see a blockage there. It's very similar to the cartoon I showed you earlier, except inverse. What symptoms would you expect? Hemiparesis. So you're going to know everything there is to know about middle cerebral artery deficits, aren't you? You have to right now. I promise I won't do another one to you. Here's one. Actually, I saw it on the dermatology lectures just a minute ago. But this is a classic fundus exam of what? This is really hypertriglyceridemia. And the one that Dr. Darrow showed was a little bit more on one-sided and a hemifield, but this is kind of diffuse. This is hypertriglyceridemia. What's the diagnosis here? This is not a stroke. Reason why you know it's not a stroke, look at the bone around the head. It's the same intensity. So this is what? It's a meningioma, calcified meningioma. 20-year-old guy comes into your office and says, good Lord, doc, I found this when I was up there looking at my eyes this morning. Am I going to be okay? What is this? It's just really a viral papilloma and it will resolve. You've heard this a couple of times during the lectures. This is a lesion occurs on the lower extremities, neither pruritic nor painful. What is this? This is necrobiosis labotica diabeticorum. What is this diagnosis? Another fundus exam, completely obliterated disc. You've got hemorrhage. Do you see cotton wool spots? Yeah, there's a couple there in the bottom, like at 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock on there. Papilledema. This is the one I promised you when I was doing the MS lecture. As I was showing you, there's a couple of little lesions from the white plaques of multiple sclerosis. But this one, usually Dr. Blackburn talks about this, I missed it. But this is one where you have pretty peripheral diffuse of the same thing. Don't get this confused. You're going to have a symptom of fever. It's going to be 84% neutrophils, as you see here. This is nocardia. And this one is a gentleman who has a rash over his left eyebrow. He's got an involved eye. This is the herpes zoster ophthalmicus, and I think I myself have been sitting in the course with you. I've heard it 5 times, so I don't think we're going to miss that one.